starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you. About living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching the coast, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Thursday, March 26th. 2015. This is Deanna Spingola, and I am broadcasting from the warm, well, it's not warm, it's sunny Chicago suburbs. This radio program is commercial free. My website is spingola.com, where you will find information about my three books, actually my four books, including the Ruling Elite series. There's also a timeline of book two and three. My new book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences, is now available at Amazon in paperback, hardcover, and also in a Kindle version. And of course, two of those versions are available from me. Please visit screeningsandyhook.com for more information about that particular book. Please also visit SpingolaSpeaks.net, created by a good friend and a longtime listener. All of the more recent audio files of my programs are at that site, including the RBN audio files, the American Free Press files, the Spingola specials, and this program. My Twitter account is twitter.com/DeannaSpingola. If you have questions, you may call in at 646-787-1915, but I would prefer that you wait until I open the phone line before you call in. We will also be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, and that is comment@spingola.com. Or we invite you to attend the chat room, which is spingola.chatango.com. Today I'm going to be talking about FDR, A Red in the White House, and it is from my third book in the trilogy, The Ruling Elite, Death, Destruction, and Domination. And it's very, very, very interesting. Well, at least I thought so when I was doing the research for it. In 1841, Clinton Roosevelt of the New York banking family wrote The Science of Government, founded on natural law, which advocated a network of highly structured, regulated communities. He supported the communization of America and the incremental elimination of the Constitution. The Rothschilds funded a committee, which included Clinton Roosevelt, to facilitate those objectives. Now, keep in mind, this was in 1841, prior to the Marx Declaration, the Communist Manifesto, which came out in 1848. Franklin D. Roosevelt may have derived inspiration for his New Deal from his cousin's book, which I mentioned is Clinton Roosevelt. In this book, Clinton Roosevelt defined a strategy for a select group of chosen people to supervise the world's population. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, members of the Communist League and both 32nd degree Freemasons, drafted what became the Communist Manifesto in 1848, a blueprint for elitist control, borrowing heavily from Clinton Roosevelt's book. The Communist Manifesto called for a graduated income tax, the removal of all rights to inheritance, a central bank, centralized communication and transportation systems, the cultivation of wastelands, free public education, and abolition of child labor. Now, that centralized communication and transportation systems, I mean, if you delve deeper into those two very important systems, then you'll find that, gosh, centralized communications is nothing more than the monopolization of all of the public airways, all of the perception managing apparatus that is currently, well, monopolized by five or six corporations worldwide. The manifesto had appeal for the middle class, which favored some of these reforms. However, Marx did not command land nationalization, which would have alienated many wealthy landowners and farmers whose funding he sought. The American Communist Party was established on September 1, 1919, with the goal of overthrowing the government by infiltration and stealth. Many of its members were Bolsheviks who had emigrated from Russia, Poland, and other Eastern European countries from 1880 to 1914. And as I'm going through this chapter, keep in mind the things that were occurring in Germany at about the same time. Now, Marxist immigrants flooded America until 1917, until Congress passed a restrictive law in 1924. During that period, about 3 million people arrived, many of them Soviet agents. After pushing four constitutional amendments through the House, Representative Emanuel Celler, C-E-L-L-E-R, worked for the next 40 years to repeal the 1924 Immigration Act, which, of course, was done in 1965. By the time the act took effect in 1929, millions of Jews had already arrived. In the House, Saul Bloom, Samuel Dickstein, and Celler led the Foreign Relations, Immigration, and Judiciary Committees, respectively. So you had Saul Bloom was in charge of Foreign Relations, Samuel Dickstein was in charge of Immigration, and Celler was in charge of Judiciary Committees. These immigrants, Marxist and non-Christian, influenced national policy, embraced and transformed the Democrat Party into a leftist coalition, and helped elect Franklin D. Roosevelt when he ran against Herbert Hoover in 1932. Previously, the Democrat Party consisted of rural Protestant Southerners and Northern Catholics who championed Christian fundamentals and traditions. Communists established a presence in almost every country at about this time, 1919, immediately following the First World War, including Britain, France, Belgium, Sweden, Denmark, Switzerland, Austria, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Greece, and in Asia. And remember that Czechoslovakia was a brand new country that had been created during the Paris Peace Conference. And let me just look in the chat room and say hi to everybody there. Hello, hello, hello. Okay, so if you have any questions, just ask them in the chat room, and I try to monitor that as well as my email. Okay. After the failed Bolshevik Revolution of 1905, now we often think of, we don't remember that there were two revolutions in Russia. One in 1905, and then the latter one, which culminated before the First World War concluded. So after the failed Bolshevik Revolution of 1905, Sidney Hillman, the dedicated Trotskyite, educated as a rabbi, relocated to America to direct world operations. In 1910, he organized a workers' strike. In 1921, he visited Russia and met with Lenin and the Supreme Council, and from 1922, took direction from Lenin. He helped found and became the president of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America, serving in that role from 1914 to 1944. In that capacity, he persuaded laborers to vote for FDR in 1932. Roosevelt regularly told people to, and I quote, clear everything with Sidney, unquote. In 1944, Hillman was FDR's special assistant and the person who told him, at Max Lowenthal's suggestion, to select Harry Truman as his vice presidential candidate. So he was in charge of the Union until 44 and then became FDR's special assistant. Probably that's kind of a perk that went along with him having done a really good job as the head of that union, which he was for 30 years. All righty. So Max Lowenthal told Hillman to tell FDR to select Harry Truman. And we know Harry Truman was a high-ranking Freemason. Now, Hillman led communists in America while he was president of the Russian American Industrial Corporation. Lowenthal was the chief advisor on Palestine to Clark Clifford, who, from 1947 to 1952, was an advisor to President Truman. So you can see all of these, all these people behind the curtain who were actually telling the president and the vice president exactly what to do. The president credited Lowenthal as the key influence behind America's recognition of Israel, which Truman did without really asking anybody else. Apparently, if Lowenthal thought it was a great idea, then okay, we'll go ahead and do it, and we won't bother to talk to Congress about any of it. Now, Roosevelt, who served as New York's governor from 1929 to 1932, asked his friend Jesse I. Strauss, the president of Macy's department store, to be the chairman of the state's Temporary Emergency Relief Administration. Now, keep in mind that when Roosevelt became president, that there was a horrific depression going on, which was orchestrated, devised with the 1929 deliberate crash of the stock market. So, the Temporary Emergency Relief Administration was created in October 1931. Strauss asked Harry L. Hopkins, the executive secretary of the Bureau of Child Welfare, to be the executive director. Hopkins became chairman when Strauss was named ambassador to France. Now, France has always been a hotbed of Freemasonry and all kinds of secretive organizations, and that's really where the big Masonic leadership was. Okay, Hopkins maintained that the federal government should administer relief, and after FDR's inauguration, he suggested this to the president. Hopkins, who headed the federal program, gave away $5 million to seven states on his very first day on the job. So previous to that, the federal government was really not involved in administering relief. It was not up to the federal government. So this was the beginning of the welfare programs of the federal government. As governor, FDR promoted old age pensions and an allegiance to the welfare state. He would do the same thing with his New Deal programs, which the Jewish community advocated and endorsed. Jews overwhelmingly supported him in 1932 and in 1936, even when others withdrew their backing in 1940 and 1944, at least 90% of the Jews voted for FDR. So, the advocates of the New Deal supported the following stipulations. Number one, repudiation of the United States Treasury's promise to pay. Number two, the confiscation of the people's gold by trickery. Number three, the debasement of currency. Number four, deliberate inflation. Number five, spoliation of savers whose little rainy day funds melted away. Number six, deficit spending to create buying power by conjury. Number seven, monetization of debt. Number eight, the doctrine of a planned economy. Number nine, taxation, class subsidies. In other words, there were just certain people who would get special money, federal grants, and the redistribution of wealth for social justice. This would reduce millions of citizens to subservience, make provinces out of the 48 sovereign states, create an executive-style government with extensive dictatorial powers, including the ability to impose regulations through bureaucratic agencies, all having the force of law and the capacity to punish the disobedient through fine or imprisonment. Now, the things that FDR enacted were absolutely horrific, egregious, and set the country in a different direction. It was all already going that way, but his administration more fully communized the country then it has continued to move forward from that time. Dwight D. Eisenhower left the New Deal intact and expanded it. In the 1960s, Lyndon B. Johnson used New Deal policies to shape his great society. Richard M. Nixon retained many of Johnson's programs. Numerous New Deal regulations and programs remain intact, even using the original names, such as the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, the Federal Crop Insurance Corporation, the Federal Housing Administration, and the Tennessee Valley Authority. The largest programs still in existence are the Social Security System and the Securities and Exchange Commission. Roosevelt took office on March 4, 1933. Title 12, U.S. Code, Section 95B states, and I quote, "The actions, regulations, rules, licenses, orders, and proclamations heretofore or hereafter taken, promulgated, made, or issued by the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Treasury since March 4th pursuant to the authority conferred by Section 95A of this title, are approved and confirmed, unquote. This refers to executive orders. According to this code, members of Congress are not required to read or vote on bills proposed by the president because since 1933, this legislation has been automatically, and I quote, approved and confirmed. This code applies to many controversial acts, including Obama's health care law, the Affordable Health Care Act. Members of Congress simply go through the charade of debate and deliberation to maintain the illusion. That is why Nancy Pelosi famously said that Congress would need to vote on the bill so that we would know what was in it. That is applicable to every other executive order. In other words, they never read the bill. They never debated on the bill. They passed the bill. And the reason they passed it was because it was already confirmed. They didn't need to debate it. It was an executive order. And Congress is not required to read or vote on bills proposed by the president since 1933. On March 6, 1933, two days after he was put in, several of the states, and I quote, pledged the faith and credit, unquote, of their governments and citizenry, and I quote again, to the aid of the national government, unquote. On March 10th, FDR called a bank holiday. On April 5th, the government prohibited the hoarding of gold. On April 20th, it prohibited the exportation of gold by individuals. On May 23rd, Representative Louis T. McFadden attempted to impeach the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Bank, the Comptroller of the Currency, and the Treasury Secretary for treason. Members of Congress, who had all sworn an oath, refused to act on his charges. Now, remember, it's up to the House of Representatives to do this, which he attempted to do, to impeach these people. On June 5th, FDR, with executive orders numbers 6073, 6102, 6111, and 6260, declared the United States bankrupt. During the Depression of the 1930s, now keep in mind what was going on in Germany. We have to make this comparison. Okay, we have a dictator in the White House, okay? Nobody's questioning. Well, but a few people were, but no one paid any attention. During the Depression of the 1930s, America suffered high unemployment. Isaac Rubinow was particularly concerned about the extent of Jewish unemployment and predicted that Jews, even educated ones, would be able to find only temporary employment, which would lead to growing maladjustment. Gosh! Furthermore, there would be, and I quote, a small minority in the field of big business, an increasing number employed in the hectic field of salesmanship, an unwilling drift to factory work, and a growing intellectual proletariat without permanent occupational status, unquote. Gosh, those poor chosen people. Jews, a minority in America, were disproportionately represented among people leading most of the left-wing groups that embraced the dogma of the Democratic Party. most Jews enthusiastically supported FDR's New Deal as a solution to the nation's growing economic ills. They backed the unions, which offered job protection and assumed influential government positions. Okay? They were brought into the government to work. You know, if they weren't going, they refused to work in the factories, then, okay, let's just have leadership positions in government. Okay, is everything okay in the chat room? Okay, alrighty. Okay, back to our selection. According to the Labor Department, about 11 million people were out of work when FDR took office. So he did put a few people to work, but he put them to work in the government. In the government. Let me backtrack here and look at those figures. Okay. He installed radicals, Fabian socialists, Stalin apologist and communist in his administration. In addition to the Soviet communist, Roosevelt and his wife Eleanor were friendly toward the Chinese communists, because there were Chinese communists already. Well, let's see. Yes, as early as 1932. Because remember that Moscow sent agents throughout a lot of countries, including in Asia. Harry Hopkins, an FDR advisor, influenced significant decisions and policies. He represented Bernard Baruch. Now, Bernard Baruch, he was talking to everybody. By 1927, Bernard Baruch was the mentor to Dwight D. Eisenhower, by 1927-28. Okay, he represented Bernard Baruch and the International Jewish Banking Cartel. Okay, so Harry Hopkins was an FDR advisor, but he was taking his orders from Baruch and the Jewish Banking Cartel. In 1937 through May 1944, Hopkins and Baruch were in continuous communication. Whitaker Chambers, a Soviet agent who later defected, claimed that FDR was merely a puppet and that a group of Jews and communists were actually running the country. This group included the following: Bernard Baruch. And Bernard Baruch made millions during World War I. Absolutely made millions. Samuel Rosenman, Raymond Moley, Felix Frankfurter, Henry Morgenthau Sr. and Jr., Harry Dexter White, Alger Hiss, Benjamin J. Cardozo, Charles W. Taussig, Nathan Margold, Charles Wyszynski, Leo Woolman, Rose Snyderman, Isidore Lubin Jr., Saul Rosenblatt, Jerome Frank, Mordecai Ezekiel, Herbert Feiss, David E. Lowenthal, Sidney Hillman, who I mentioned before, Albert Taussig, who was probably related to Charles W. Taussig. Then we have Alexander Sachs. Wonder if he has any relationship to Saks Fifth Avenue, probably. Maurice Karp, Robert Freshner, Robert Strau, Ronald Richberg, Ferdinand Picora, Samuel Untermeyer, James Landis, Samuel Dickstein, Herbert Lehman, and I'll talk more about Dickstein momentarily. Herbert Lehman, James P. Warburg, part of the Warburg banking family, David Stern, Henry Horner, Louis Kirstein, Benjamin V. Cohen, Walter Lippmann, who was heavy time into journalism, William C. Bullitt, Alfred Burrell, Joseph Proskauer, Nathan Margolin, Abe Fortas, Saul Padover, Albert Arendt, Felix Cohen, and hundreds of other Jews. FDR appointed Harvard law professor Felix Frankfurter, born in Vienna, as a Supreme Court justice. He was FDR's legal advisor in the creation of national policies and decisions on whom to appoint to influential government positions. Washington insiders often referred to Frankfurter as the president, and certainly FDR was just a front man for Felix Frankfurter. In 1933, Roosevelt gave Rose Snyderman a position on the Labor Advisory Board created under the National Recovery Act. Anna Rosenberg was on the board of the National Recovery Administration and on the War Manpower Commission in the Defense Department during the war. Secretary of Labor Frances Perkins named Dorothy Jacobs Belanca to head the Maternal and Child Welfare Committee. In 1936, Eleanor Roosevelt invited Pauline Newman and a delegation of female garment and textile workers to spend a week at the White House. Rosenberg, President Harry S. Truman's Assistant Secretary of Defense, ultimately became a wealthy public relations professional for corporate America. The United States had severed diplomatic relations with Russia on December 6, 1917, because the Bolsheviks had refused to honor debts that the Tsarist government had incurred. Henry Morgenthau and Dean Acheson, both Felix Frankfurter protégés, invited Maxim Litvinov, born Litvinov Finkelstein, to the White House to finalize recognition of the Soviet Union with FDR, something the Soviets had sought for 17 years. Litvinov was one of the Bolshevik conspirators who held a strategy session with Trotsky, Lenin, Stalin, and Kaganovich in Switzerland before going to Russia just prior to the revolution. Acheson, formerly a law clerk for Justice Brandeis, was one of Stalin's lawyers even before FDR recognized the Soviets. Now, why does Stalin need a lawyer? Well, who knows? And he came right straight out of being a clerk for Justice Brandeis, who was appointed to the Supreme Court in, I think, mid-1916 by Woodrow Wilson. Okay. One of Roosevelt's first official acts was welcoming Litvinov, besides all of those other official acts, was welcoming Litvinov to the White House. FDR, from a prominent, wealthy capitalist family, began transforming America into a communist state. Now, keep in mind what Hitler was doing in Germany. He was getting rid of all the Jewish influence in high government and other high capacities, from education, from the media, from the theater, just trying to eliminate them from running Germany, where in fact FDR was doing just exactly the opposite. He was transforming America into a communist state. He legitimized the Bolsheviks after they had plundered Russia and had starved and slaughtered millions of Russians. He knew exactly what kind of people the Bolsheviks were, but yet he collaborated with them. Litvinov had several strategies for communizing the American hemisphere, and now the Bolsheviks had a president who would gladly cooperate with those objectives. Many patriotic organizations and individuals implored FDR not to develop allegiances with Moscow. However, he took the advice from the Marxists, including the intellectuals, the labor union radicals, and the university professors. Dean Acheson and Henry Morgenthau, who I mentioned were both Felix Frankfurter proteges, convinced FDR without congressional approval to sanction the establishment of a Soviet embassy and to recognize the Soviet government, which he did on November 16, 1933, just towards the end of the year after he was put into office, which we said happened on March 4, 1933. Okay, Acheson, founder of the Atlantic Council, is considered responsible for creating NATO and imposing it on Europe. FDR then appointed Acheson and Morgenthau to study trade opportunities with the Soviets. Now, this was as early as 1933 because they were ramping up for more warfare, and in order to make that happen, they had to start trading. Now, they had already started trading in the 1920s, where a lot of the United American people went over to the Soviet Union to help them modernize their farm equipment and that kind of thing. But FDR wanted even more trade opportunities, which would, of course, have everything in place for the Lend-Lease operation. Okay, FDR's advisors, most of them Jews, all advocated communism. They were close to the international bankers and were anxious to destroy Germany. Now, remember that Hitler came to power in January of 33, a couple of months before FDR came to power. Russian-born Isidor Lubin was a U.S. representative to the United Nations. Russian-born Leo Pazvolsky held an influential position in the State Department and was the executive director of the Committee on the Post-War Program, meaning the post-war program after World War I. Samuel Rosenman, as special counsel, wrote most of FDR's speeches. Herbert Lehman, director of the UN Relief and Rehabilitation Administration, directed funds mostly from the United States to Soviet satellite countries as a consequence of the Yalta and Potsdam decisions, which would come later on, right after the war. Lehman had been Roosevelt's lieutenant governor in New York. And although the UN was not formalized until after the war, they intended to have a United Nations formally in place by the end of the war. Okay, let's talk about Roosevelt's ethnic background. The Daily Citizen. Let me just peek in the chat room, see if there's any questions or comments. Yes. Teddy Roosevelt was in China in 05. He was laying a lot of groundwork there, and of course there were also Russians in China working with with the people there early on, and it was the Marxists were all over. They were in Russia, they were in China, they were had an agent in every country, nearly every country. Okay, the Daily Citizen of Tucson, Arizona, published a genealogical pedigree of FDR on February 29, 1934. In addition, Dr. H.H. Laughlin directed the preparation of a genealogical chart for FDR for the Carnegie Institution, which the Associated Press News Agency dispatched to its membership on March 7, 1934. So, interesting. Both documents claim to substantiate Roosevelt's Jewish ancestry, which provides an explanation for many of his radical policies and his administration's legislation. It also reveals why he favored hundreds of Jews, socialists, and communists for high positions within the government. On March 14, 1935, the New York Times quoted him as saying, and I quote, "In the distant past, my ancestors may have been Jews. All I know about the origin of the Roosevelt family is that they are apparently descended from Claes Martensen van Roosevelt, who came from Holland," unquote. Now, according to a book, let's see, I don't have it on my desk. What did I do with that book? I have a book. It's over in the bookshelf that talks about or more or less confirms this, that the Roosevelts and even the Rockefellers had Jewish backgrounds. But anyway, I've talked about that book previously. FDR's mother was Sarah Delano, probably from a family that may have been part of the migration of Sephardic Jews who fled from Spain to Portugal and from there to Antwerp after the closure of Antwerp's harbor in 1585. The Jews went to Amsterdam and through the generations became part of the community's business class. However, by choice, they remained a separate ethnic minority. FDR's wife was a distant cousin and a niece of Theodore Roosevelt. So, given their tendency to intermarry, I think we kind of see it there. The Universal Jewish Dictionary of 1943 states, after Sarah Delano Roosevelt's death in 1941, the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation purchased the Roosevelt home in New York City and converted it into the Sarah Delano Roosevelt Interfaith House for students of Hunter College. So, that's kind of interesting. The Associated Press on May 8, 1937 reported, and I quote, "President Roosevelt will receive the 10th award of the Gotthilf Medal for Distinguished Services to Jewry," unquote. On December 23, 1938, he was awarded another Jewish medal, according to the New York Herald Tribune of that date. Some Jewish organizations referred to him as, and I quote, "the new Moses," unquote. On May 14, 1939, Professor Johann van Leers of Berlin conducted an exhaustive analysis, quote unquote, of FDR's ancestry and concluded that, in fact, Sarah Delano was from a Jewish blood family. He said that the Delano family descended from an Italian or Spanish Jewish family. A large number of Jewish settlers emanated from Holland. New York Jews on the east side, and a lot of those ended up, of course, in New York. New York Jews on the East Side regularly referred to the president as Rosenfeld, R-O-S-E-N-V-E-L-T. Okay, FDR's decisions at the Yalta Conference, which occurred February 4th to the 11th, 1945, accommodated Stalin and the Soviets and helped spread communism in China, in Eastern Europe, and especially in America. He accomplished more for the communists than anyone else outside of the USSR did. Yeah, he sure did. Okay. Now a subtitle in the chapter, Targeting the National Socialist. Lithuanian-born Samuel Dickstein, a liberal Jew, a good friend to Rabbi Wise, originated the idea of establishing the House Un-American Activities Committee. Now, he's a member of Congress, and he was in the New York legislature. Okay. Allegedly to investigate communist activities in America, but more important, to target right-wing seditionists, especially National Socialists. So Dickstein was the originator of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Dickstein served in the New York legislature from 1919 to 1922 and sponsored the state's first kosher food laws. Now, we've talked about kosher food laws on several of my programs, not recently, but they're very interesting. And just about everything in your kitchen, if you look at the package, will have a kosher mark on it. Okay, thereafter, 22 other states adopted similar kosher food laws. In 1933, he had called for a congressional investigation of anarchists. Interestingly, he was, for many years, a Soviet agent nicknamed Crook. He gave committee transcripts and names of possible double agents to the Russians, for which he received about $183,000. Okay. To further take the focus off of what the Jews were doing, on January 3rd, 1934, Dickstein, as the chairman of the Committee on Naturalization and Immigration, introduced and got passed a resolution to initiate an official investigation of pro-Nazi activities in America. Dickstein, who was breaking new ground, claimed to have numerous smuggled documents, quote-unquote, letters, and an individual, a Mr. X, who was willing to testify. During the floor debate on the resolution, a representative from Nebraska suggested that the whole thing is a scheme by the Jews to offend German Americans like those in my state, he said, who admire Hitler, unquote. Others opined that the real danger facing America stemmed from communists and their fellow travelers. In those days, a buzzword for Jews and foreigners. However, Congress passed Dickstein's resolution by a vote of 168-31. German Americans were becoming so influential and effective that Moscow was concerned. Therefore, the Soviets strengthened their counterattack against pro-German activities and organizations in America. They were so effective that, according to Soviet intelligence, they triggered William Randolph Hearst's antagonism toward the Soviet Union, which they viewed as a big problem. They sought to obtain incriminating material on him and his potential relationship with National Socialist Germany. They also attempted to position an internal source inside the Hearst organization. The New York Post had a Soviet agent who revealed information gathered from one of Hearst's journalists. In September 1935, Soviet officials considered German influence in the Soviet Union to be so powerful that they had to counter it, using their agents with the following objectives. Number one, exposure of German work directed against Soviet interests with respect both to worsening Soviet relations with the United States and intelligence work directed against Soviet institutions in America and in the USSR. Number two, exposure of alleged German agents in USS or U.S. institutions, first of all, in the State Department and intelligence organizations. So what they're doing is saying, oh, gosh, there's a bunch of agents and Nazi agents in the State Department and other, that wasn't true. The biggest amount of agents were the Soviet agents. Number three, exposure of alleged German work against the Communist Party of the United States. Okay, the Soviets decided that their best strategy was to direct public attention to anti-Semitism. Given that several Jewish organizations were already in place to fight anti-Semitism, this would be efficacious. Many Jewish politicians, some of them working as Soviet agents within the government, would augment the material produced by the Jewish factions. In the 1930s, there was rampant anti-Semitism in America, particularly in the Midwest. And there was reason for it. There was Father Charles Coughlin of Detroit, dubbed the radio priest, and William D. Pelley of Minneapolis, among others, who openly called for dismissing Jews from positions of responsibility, if not driving them from the country itself. And certainly that's what Germany was attempting to do. Organized brown shirts in New York and silver shirts in Minneapolis outraged and terrorized American Jewry. While the older and more respectable Jewish organizations pondered a response that would not alienate non-Jewish supporters, others, including a few rabbis, asked gangsters to break up American, what they referred to as American Nazi rallies. Jewish leaders, according to Robert Rockaway in the Journal of the American Jewish Historical Society, had a difficult time with the German-American Bund rallies in New York City. Despite their efforts to halt them, there were no legal grounds. New York State Judge Nathan Perlman requested the help of Meyer Lansky, an organized crime leader, in breaking up the rallies. Perlman's only stipulation was that Lansky's cronies beat the Bundists, but not kill any of them. Lansky declined any payment for the assignment, but later said, and I quote, "I was a Jew and felt for those Jews in Europe who were suffering. They were my brothers," unquote. His accomplices disrupted numerous National Socialist rallies. They broke lots of arms, legs, ribs, and skulls, but did not kill anyone. 15 of Lansky's boys broke up a brown shirt demonstration in Manhattan. A swastika and a photo of Hitler were on stage. They threw some of the attendees out of windows and chased and beat many others. Jews wanted to show that they would not sit back and accept insults, quote unquote. Pelley planned a silver shirt Legion rally in Minneapolis to save, and I quote, America from an imaginary Jewish communist conspiracy. It wasn't imaginary. It was for real, folks. Minneapolis gambling czar David Berman and his Jewish cronies interrupted the rally held at an Elks Lodge. Now, keep in mind that this whole time that the National Socialists, Americans who were Germans, who sympathized with Germany, were trying to have rallies. The Jews and the mafia, run by Lansky, run by Jews, they say the mafia was always run by Italians, but they got the Italians to do a lot of dirty work, but it was the Jews who ran the mafia. Okay, so they were not allowing, they were using gangsters, organized gangsters, to destroy these perfectly legitimate rallies held by the Germans who had National Socialist chapter here in this country. The National Socialist leader referred to the invaders as, and I quote, Jew bastards, unquote, whom the city should expel. Berman and others rushed into the meeting room and began busting heads, ultimately emptying the hall. Berman, covered with blood, grabbed the microphone and declared, "This is a warning. Anybody who says anything against Jews gets the same treatment, only next time it will be worse." Unquote. He disrupted two other rallies, ending the Silver Shirt meetings in Minneapolis. Following World War II, Jewish gangsters aided in the establishment of the Israeli state. In 1945, Benjamin Bugsy Siegel, part of the Lansky Crime Syndicate, met with Reuven Daphne, a Haganah emissary, and paid him $50,000 in cash, with which he acquired guns and ammunition to forcibly persuade the British to leave Palestine. Siegel was under the erroneous impression that Jews were docile and submissive and unwilling to fight. Daphne assured him that Jews were fearless fighters. In fact, Jews had engaged in terrorism for decades. The lengthy history of Jewish criminality, whether on the streets, in the casinos, or in their efforts to take over countries and steal natural assets, is well recognized. Israel misrepresented itself in the worldwide media as the Middle East bulwark of democracy, quote unquote, throughout the Cold War, especially after the dissolution of Israeli-USSR relations. The Trotskyites, otherwise known as neocons, like Bill Kristol and his associates, introduced the term Islamofascist to refer to the Muslims, this era's version of the Nazis, a group they have destined for destruction. Dick Stein investigated and began harassing the German-American Bund, formally established in March 1936, calling it a subversive organization. On February 20th, 1939, at New York's Madison Square Garden, 20,000 people attended a rally at which Fritz Kuhn delivered a speech criticizing FDR, referring to him as Frank D. Rosenfeld and blasting his Jew deal. He said that America's leadership was under Bolshevik Jewish control. The German-American Bund was closely associated with Father Coughlin. The FBI investigated its relationship to the National Socialist Party in Germany. The Bund issued several publications, one entitled What Price the Federal Reserve? Read the Protocols of the Elders of Zion to Understand the New Deal. In this open letter, dated January 14, 1938, to Secretary Chester Morrill of the Board of Governors of Federal Reserve System, N.W. Rogers pointed out that a massive number of Jewish immigrants had taken positions of authority in the government. In March 1935, some 647 million was, by executive order, withdrawn from circulation by calling in the bonds backing national bank notes in exchange for Federal Reserve notes. Rogers wrote, but the Federal Reserve banks, in turn, surrendered the bonds for gold notes. It would seem that in the transaction there was something suggestive of swindling. The Federal Deposit Insurance Act, as amended in 1935, extracted some $290 million more from the taxpayers. So you see, what they were doing was creating even more devastation during the Depression here. In Germany, they were creating usury-free currency that people could spend into the economy, which would create jobs, which would then give... It was just a wonderful system. But instead, executive orders issued, well, in March 1935... the government was actually withdrawing money from circulation. They played a big swindle. So that, in fact, it cost the American public, the taxpayers, $290 million. Rogers described the cruel and merciless process of farm foreclosures and mortgages that rob industrious, thrifty, peaceable, country-loving, law-abiding American citizens of years of weary toil to turn over to men who never performed a day's labor, produced a dollar's worth of wealth, rendered any useful services to society, who have done nothing, in fact, to aid the advancement of a true civilization or to furnish the slightest pretext for their own existence. Okay? So, during the time that Hitler and their economic programs were enabling the farmers to farm even more land and helping the independent farmers to enrich their soil and to reclaim some land that wasn't as fertile. The government here in America was getting rid, through foreclosure and mortgages, the farmers of America, and turning over a lot of that land to other people. Rogers compared them to, and I quote, parasites that fatten on other organisms, unquote, but said they were worse than parasites which, and I quote, do not intimidate, discriminate, or deceive their prey, using ruthless indifference to extract the very lifeblood of their helpless victims. Now, during the 1930s, and I've had a gentleman on my program in the past who talked about at least 7 million people disappearing during the Depression years. And it was through activities like this and people who were moving, going west, trying to find work, who ended up somewhere. Not in California. Probably starving to death in the desert somewhere in Nevada. And we of course had the Dust Bowl, which was created, I think, deliberately, which I do talk about in this book. This, he said, Roger said, was, and I quote, evidently the chief cause of the Depression, which started the basic industry, communicated itself to every other branch of the industrial organization, causing a dislocation of the various parts of the whole intricate network of production, unquote. NKVD records, made public after the collapse of the Soviet Union, revealed Dick Stein's role as an agent. The Roosevelt administration and the Jewish-controlled media collaborated with the congressman in demonizing and incarcerating Fritz Kuhn, the Bund's chairman, on a fabricated embezzlement charge in 1939. In other words, they blocked him away. Author Philippa Sturm, S-T-U-R-M, failed to mention Dick Stein's investigation and harassment of the group, but explained that the Bund ended its activities because the American media were carrying stories of Hitler's troop rampaging through Europe, and with the American military draft in place, the Nazis stopped marching. No. The National Socialist chapter in America was destroyed by the mafia in conjunction with the government, in conjunction with the Jews who were controlling the government, at the behest of that judge in New York, and because a congressman went after Fritz Kuhn, the Bund's chairman, and fabricated a charge. Wow. Okay, let's talk about the Martin Dies or Dies Committee. It's spelled D-I-E-S. I don't know whether that's Dies or Dies. Martin Dies, chairman of the House Committee for the Investigation of Un-American Activities, asked the new Congress for $1 million to fund a probe of the Works Progress Administration and the Public Works Administration, that's the WPA and the PWA. He stated his determination to rid the government of saboteurs as Harry Hopkins, Harold Ickes, I-C-K-E-S, Francis Perkins, and other communists and fellow travelers, and that's in quotes. The investigation failed as FDR stacked the government with people who would not censure their and advised him to try to become Secretary of War. Baruch saw war looming and believed that the War Department would become the most significant of all agencies. Of course, Baruch saw war looming. That's what they'd been planning since the end of the First World War. He devised and was a key author of the Industrial Mobilization Plan that would enable the country to pass from a peace to a war status with a minimum of confusion, waste, and cost. Okay. And this was Hopkins at the behest of Bernard Baruch. Okay, the Secretary. Okay, FDR told Dies to stop annoying the communists because, and I quote, "We need those votes." Unquote. Roosevelt endeavored to squelch the congressman's investigation, which found that there were at least 2,000 communist subversives working within the federal government. FDR allowed the strategic placement of many European refugees, quote unquote, at the beginning of World War II, and let these non-citizens obtain important government positions without official investigation. That's like having dual citizens, which, of course, is what we have in Congress now. They may not actually have dual citizenship, but we know that at least 300 of them signed a paper stating that they were for Israel and gave it to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Look at all the people, look at all of the congressmen who have gone to Israel on those junkets to learn about Israel. Sickening. This initiated the policy of arbitrary hiring, which dictated that the government could not, this initiated the policy of arbitrary hiring, which dictated that the government could not deny employment to individuals based on race, creed, or national origin, a policy detrimental to American security, especially involving the so-called atomic projects. There were numerous Soviet operatives within the Roosevelt administration. Let me take a peek in the chat room and also check my email to see if I have any questions or comments. Okay. 30 said, the leadership of the Bund went from Kuhn to Kuntz to Lapro as federal false charges were levied against each in succession. Okay, it went to Klaproth. Klaproth was the last one. Wow. Okay. Somebody else said, Force is the guarantor of the state. How many of the generals are Jewish, and what percentage of the Secret Service are Jewish? Interestingly, somebody sent me, a gentleman that sends me a lot of things in the mail, sent me a list. It was just a Wikipedia list of all of the generals who are Jewish. And it was quite a lengthy list. Quite a lengthy list indeed. Now, somebody else said that Eisenhower was a Swedish Jew. He was referred to as a Swedish Jew when he was at West Point. However, in a program that I did on Tuesday, it's a pre-recorded program that I did with Mike Williams where I talked about this. Believe it or not, the Eisenhower family came from Germany. Okay? He wasn't Swedish. He may have been Jewish. He may have been a crypto-Jew, because the Eisenhowers came from Germany early on, came to this country, and they came to Pennsylvania. He conceded that his family was Pennsylvania Deutsch or Dutch, and then in an email, or not an email, in a letter to his wife, he said, God, I hate the Germans. Why do I hate the Germans? Because they are monsters. So I would say, now, if you visit Jew or no Jew, I believe they give Eisenhower a 5 or 6. But they say, unfortunately, that he is not a Jew. However, given his activities, given his background, his country of origin being Germany, he either hates he's a self-hating German, or he's a Jew from Germany who served the Jewish community here in this country. But that's Eisner, so let's get back to Ike. Sorry I got off topic there. I just wanted to clarify that, and I hope that you will have an opportunity, that the listeners will have an opportunity to listen to that interview that I did on Tuesday. And Mike Williams said that he would have it available shortly. And as soon as it is available, I will let people know either via my my website or in the chat room or via my email list. So anyway, okay, back to the book. There were numerous Soviet operatives within the Roosevelt administration, some directed by American American Communist Party leader Earl Browder. I see a typo in the book. It says American Community Party. It should have been communist. Oh, gosh. Every book has errors. Let me be the first to admit that. Every book has errors. All of them. Because people are the ones that do the editing. And obviously, the editor didn't see that. And I didn't see it either. Okay. Earl Browder was the leader of the American Communist Party. In addition to the infiltrators who staffed a growing number of bureaucratic agencies, some operated in the WARE group, W-A-R-E, and later during the war in the Silver Master Network under Soviet agent and economist Nathan G. Silvermaster, who kept tight control over the officials who were collecting and transferring intelligence to the Soviets while implementing programs beneficial to Moscow. In recent times, government infiltrators like Jonathan Pollard and Ben-Ami Kadish have shared strategic intelligence with the Israeli state. Like the Rosenbergs, they receive punishment just to keep up the appearance that the U.S. government frowns on such behavior, like unapproved espionage, versus the kind in which the government routinely engages. Yet American taxpayers fund Israeli programs, including terrorism, throughout the Middle East. Agents are in Congress. And I mentioned earlier, 300 members formally professed their allegiance to the Israelis in a letter sent in March 2010 to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, reaffirming their commitment to, and I quote, the unbreakable bond, unquote, that exists between the United States and the Israeli state. Marxists seized to obliterate Christianity and church-operated organizations wherever they can. In 1939, Edwin D. Schoonmaker, editor of American Hebrew in Democracy and World Dominion, wrote, and I quote, "According to such information that the writer could secure while in Russia a few weeks ago, not one Jewish synagogue has been torn down, as have hundreds, perhaps thousands, of the Greek Catholic churches. In Moscow and other large cities, one can see Christian churches in the process of destruction. The government needs a location for a large building, or apostate Jews leading a revolution that was to destroy religion, as the opiate people had somehow spared the synagogues of Russia." U.S. immigration laws, unquote. U.S. immigration laws were deplorably inadequate, and politicians failed to address the issue and were negligent in enforcing the immigration laws that they passed. Gosh, imagine that. Congress failing to enforce the immigration laws. What do you know? We wouldn't think that they would do that. After World War II, illegal entry increased. At least 5 million aliens were identified under the Alien Registration Act of 1940. Because of official laxity in upholding the nation's laws, communists found exercising influence relatively easy, and this led to the infiltration of the government. In 1950, hundreds of thousands of foreigners were arrested, but subsequently released because the government did not have provisions for deporting them. Oh, heavens. In October 1941, communist apologists Eleanor Roosevelt, Wendell Willkie, George Field, Dorothy Thompson, Herbert Swope, and other prominent journalists, academics, trade unionists, theologians, and public officials would create Freedom House, a CFR front. FDR encouraged the group's covert propaganda activities, hoping this would persuade Americans to accept entry into World War II. Freedom House was also instrumental in facilitating and supporting post-war policies like the Marshall Plan, NATO, and the UN. So, I mean, when we see things like this, and we know the Council on Foreign Relations. Okay, so the Council on Foreign Relations was created during the Paris Peace Conference, and they are the ones that created Freedom House. Okay, moving right along here. Let me just bounce into the chat room, and okay. All righty. Back to the reorganization. In 1936, FDR created the President's Committee on Administrative Management, chaired by Lewis Brownlow, to devise ways to implement sweeping changes in the executive branch to enable him to usurp and exercise almost limitless power. Now, keep in mind that this is what FDR was doing here. We never hear about this, ever. We never, ever, ever hear about the changes in the American government. I mean, structural changes. But we hear about, oh, Hitler was doing this and doing that. He was trying to take over the entire country. Oh, he was a terrible dictator. Look, oh. It was just awful what he was doing. But we've seen what went on in the 30s under Rosenfeld. Okay. Brownlow co-authored a report that led to the passage of the Reorganization Act of April 3rd, 1939, and the creation of the Executive Office of the President. A totally different position. The chaos and massive deaths of World War II completed the draconian bureaucratic changes and constitutional distortions. Roosevelt and his communist cronies changed the entire government structure. The executive branch grew exponentially, with a plethora of cabinet seats and unelected bureaucrats answerable only to the president. Now, there were certain departments, but not the cabinet seats that we have now. Federal officials formed numerous entities to deal with any economic emergency, quote unquote. Now, these included the Social Security Administration, and the Council of State Governments. This was so that they could reach those federal tentacles into the state governments. And we have governors now attending meetings just precisely for governors. Okay, within a few years, these agencies operated as trustees, quote-unquote, for foreign creditors under the umbrella of the Declaration of Interdependence, dated January 22, 1937. Lawyers associated with these agencies function under a different set of rules. An alternative constitution in order to, and I quote, help implement international treaties of the United States or where world uniformity would be desirable, unquote. This was before World War II. Declaration of Interdependence, January 22, 1937. Robert Bork wrote, and I quote, "We are increasingly governed not by law or elected representatives, but by an unelected, unrepresentative, unaccountable committee of lawyers applying no will but their own," unquote. These lawyers and their agents are the trustees for the bankruptcy, acting in the interest of foreign creditors and powers. Under the reorganization of the bankruptcy, individuals representing foreign creditors appointed the Treasury Secretary as the receiver. And this is under the reorganization plan number 26, 5 USCA 903, Public Law 94-564, Legislative History, page 5967. A bankrupt entity forfeits control of a business to the Office of Receiver. The Federal Reserve and its member branches function as official depositories for the debt. The state of emergency declared by FDR still exists and is permanent due to the insolvency of America, which is now a corporator, a member of a corporation, which Clint Richardson has talked about numerous times. Okay. An emergency does not justify abuse of constitutional power. Because the U.S. government is now a corporation ruled by a corporate charter, it assumes the characteristics of a private citizen and is no longer a sovereign. America is no longer a nation, but is under the bank's jurisdiction, the head corporate power. On February 16, 1939, FDR wrote, and I quote, "A thorough and comprehensive study should be made of existing practices and procedures with a view to detecting any existing deficiencies and pointing the way to improvements," unquote. He approved of independent regulatory commissions, which in effect create, I quote, "a fourth branch of the government for which there is no sanction in the Constitution," unquote. Congress passed the Administrative Procedure Bill, but surprisingly, Roosevelt vetoed it on December 18, 1940, since he opposed the Supreme Court's defense of property rights and its rulings that many aspects of the New Deal were unconstitutional. Among these was the Agricultural Adjustment Act, passed on May 12, 1933, and drafted by Henry A. Wallace, Secretary of Agriculture from 1933 to 1940, and Vice President from 1941 to 1945. This law restricted agricultural production by paying farmers subsidies not to plant on portions of their land and encouraged them to kill off excess livestock. The court also questioned the National Industrial Recovery Act, which protected collective bargaining rights for unions. FDR wanted, and I quote, "an exponential increase in legal duties and a vast new centralized apparatus of federal law enforcement, a bureaucratized regulatory state, unquote. He called for a broader understanding of the Constitution and hoped to reshape the court with justices more sympathetic to the New Deal. That's why he vetoed it. He wanted even more power, even greater bureaucratic power, more regulations. And on June 11th, 1946, Truman, picking up the Marxist gauntlet for expansion of the executive office, approved the Administrative Procedures Act that Roosevelt initiated on February 16, 1939. Okay, so Truman went ahead and passed it after it gave the government, the executive branch, even more power. An administrative report described a federal agency as a governmental unit with, and I quote, the power to determine private rights and obligations, unquote. The report elaborated on 51 agencies. Government officials created 11 of those agencies just before and following Lincoln's War, the so-called Civil War. From 1865 to 1900, officials created 6 additional agencies. Now, keep in mind, I always have referred to Lincoln's War, the so-called Civil War, was actually the first successful Marxist revolution in the world. The Marxist revolutions in 1848 were not successful. The first successful Marxist revolution was the so-called Civil War. Okay? And then each war, World War I, World War II, even created more power within the communist government under which America is currently living. Okay, with every year or choreographed crises, the federal government seizes extraordinary power, otherwise unattainable and wholly unsanctioned by the Constitution. Oh, and the Constitution was a rather loose document to begin with. I think if you go back to the document before the Constitution, which I just had memory failure here, was a much better document. And anyway, we're in deep trouble, people. Okay. The Congressional Record of 1946 states, and I quote, "We have set up a fourth order in the tripart plan of government, which was initiated by the founding fathers of our democracy. They set up the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch. But since that time, we have set up a fourth dimension, if I may so term it, which is now popularly known as administrative in nature. So we have the legislative, the executive, the judicial, and the administrative. Perhaps there are reasons for that arrangement. We found that the legislative branch, although it might enact law, could not very well administer it. So the legislative branch enunciated the legal precepts and ordained that commissions or groups should be established by the executive branch with power to promulgate rules and regulations," unquote. And so we're going back to that regulated society that Clinton Roosevelt imagined. Okay, administrative agencies publish and promulgate regulations in the Federal Register, arranged by topic in what is called the Code of Federal Regulations. And Clint Richardson has taught a lot about these codes. And, of course, one of those codes is how we are used for guinea pigs, that the federal government, of course, in conjunction and in bed with pharmaceutical industry, can pretty much do whatever they want to us. You know, if they want to use us for medical experiments or well, the whole medical industry is experimental, and we are the guinea pigs. We're all in clinical trials. If you're taking any pharmaceutical drugs, you are now involved in a clinical trial, people. Let me just look in the chat room here. Okay, let's see. Okay. No, actually, I'm not. It's not my, because I'm not posting in the chat room. So, and I have, somebody said that it must be Deanna's Chat Tango bopper going off, but I'm not posting anything. In fact, I haven't posted anything. I'm just checking in there every once in a while. I didn't even say good morning. I didn't write a text message to anybody in the chat room. I'm just here. I'm eavesdropping in the chat room today. Let me just say a hi. Just let everybody know that I am here. Okay. All righty. Let's go back to the document here. Truman supervised. Now remember that Roosevelt had instructions from his Jewish handlers that he was supposed to put Truman in as his vice presidential candidate. So Truman, after Roosevelt died, supervised a categorical shift from a representative government to a military dictatorship. The United States is now a fully militarized war machine, prepared to forcefully impose obedience to global governance. The American populace, with little dissent, has tolerated the intolerable and has accepted the unacceptable. We have proven our gullibility and steadfast devotion to the idolatrous Jewish state. We have gradually relinquished our will and abandoned the essential loyalties that characterized us as caring, compassionate citizens. How can a country, ostensibly guided and therefore supposedly preferred by God, possibly be in error? And remember, we have absolutely nothing to fear from Sharia law, because we are already under another law. And when I listen infrequently to the TV news and I hear all this nonsense about ISIS and all these other things, I think, well, we are the militarized war machine, and we have, in order to be a militarized war machine, prepared to forcefully impose obedience, there needs to be to global governance. We need to get everybody to be obedient. And if there's anybody on the planet, heaven help it, those people on the planet who won't knuckle down and be under the fist of communism, if that's what you would call it now, then they have to be, they have to be bombed and threatened and killed. That's just all there is to it. Okay. I think we're ready to take some phone calls. If you'd like to call into the program, and I'd certainly be happy to have some questions from the chat room. And if there's anybody in the chat room that would like to call in and ask some questions or make some comments, I would love to hear from you. And that number, again, that you can call into is 646-787-1915. We have about 20 minutes to have some comments and questions. I mean, I can share more with you, certainly, but I would like to hear from you. The next selection is The Genesis of Factory Farming, and which also, of course, has to do with the things that happened during the 1930s, and with this this new interdependence, that doctrine of interdependence. That is amazing because, as I mentioned in my other book, Sandy Hook, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. I talk a bit about that. I talk about the FDA, and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, and I mean, they have their tentacles not just in this country, but in other countries. And you have to think, gosh, what's the FDA doing in that country, or what's the FDA doing in what's going on here? And so, and you also have people outside of this country who aren't even citizens, who've never paid into the Social Security, are collecting Social Security. And you have to wonder, what's going on? And you have all of these funds and this money that is going out of this country, and the transfer of gold from this country started with the establishment of the Federal Reserve, and I talk about that in my first book. You could not have any transfer of gold until you had the Federal Reserve system. That was necessary to have that system, and you could not have had World War I without the Federal Reserve. So, anyway, anybody calling in? Let me look in. In there, and nope, no callers. Gosh, everybody's quiet today. Okay, let me just check my email here. See if there's any email questions. Okay. Let me talk a little bit about the genesis of factory farming. Whenever somebody sends me the link to one of those, a YouTube video, where they talk about how the animals are treated, and I mean, I watched a couple of those. I was just flabbergasted, absolutely flabbergasted by how terrible, how awful the animals are treated. Now, I'm a big animal lover. I love all animals. I mean, I'm not crazy about bugs, spiders, that kind of thing. But I appreciate the animal kingdom. Even snakes. Snakes do not bother me. I've handled snakes before. You know, they're not slimy. They're just, you know, they're just snakes. But I think that we are supposed to be the stewards of animals here on the planet. I believe that we are supposed to care for them, treat them with respect, and not certainly inhumanely slaughter them. Now, I am a meat eater. At one point in time, I decided that I was going to be a vegetarian because I didn't want to be eating animals. But then I thought, well, gosh, I'm wearing leather shoes. I believe that animals were put on the planet, on the earth, to help us. And, I do eat them, and I feel better when I have protein in my diet. So anyway, let's begin this next chapter, the genesis of factory farming. It didn't start recently. Heaven forbid it did not start recently, but as early as 1909 and 1920s. In 1909, Congress, with absolutely no understanding of the physical conditions on the plains, passed the Enlarged Homestead Act, offering farmers 320 acres in order to promote dry land farming in the more marginal lands, especially in the Great Plains. This let, now, before they got 160 acres as a homestead grant. This led to an influx of new farmers who lacked the knowledge of proper cultivation techniques and ecology. A homesteader using animal power to till and harvest would be unable to cultivate 1,500 acres, the amount experts suggested for dry land farming. Beginning in 1913, Edwin L. Currier with the Montana State College Farm Management Program taught farmers how to update their deficient practices and how to implement basic accounting principles. In other words, they were trying to turn independent farmers who could easily handle their land into big business people. They were more concerned about money and probably exploiting the land rather than working with the land, rather than working in conjunction with the land. They wanted to exploit it and also be, it would not be putting back into the land what they were taking out of. So it was not going to be a good thing ecologically. But they wanted to make businessmen out of farmers. On July 17, 1916, Congress, with the Federal Farm Loan Act, created the Federal Farm Loan Board, 12 regional farm loan banks, and thousands of farm loan associations. The Rothschilds and their political minions were concerned about the small farmers who were stockpiling and wholesaling their grain. Under the guise of assisting independent farmers, they advocated the loan system, which has cursed, indebted, and ultimately destroyed many farmers. Former Senator Richard F. Pettigrew noted in the British Guardian, and I quote, "This system of banking, causing the ultimate ruin for all those who cultivate the soil, was the invention of Samuel Jones Lloyd with the assistance of the Rothschilds, bankers of Europe," unquote. So keep in mind that they came into this country. They created this this branch of the government, the Federal Farm Loan Board, which were 12 regional farm loan banks and thousands of farm loan associations. It was the Rothschilds that were behind this creation, this guise to attack the small independent farmer. This started during World War I under the presidential under the president Woodrow Wilson, and it's kind of interesting that there are 12 regional farm. There were 12 regional farm loan banks. There are 12. Aren't there 12 FEMA districts, or are they 10? But there are also Federal Reserve regions. I mean, it's all very, if you make comparisons between these different apparatuses, these different networks and things, you see a lot of commonality. Anyway, in 1917, Pettigrew, the senator, told a journalist that the World War was a capitalist scheme to further enrich the wealthy. Now, remember that the Rothschilds, and I talk about this in my first bank, created both communism and capitalism. They're both the same. Okay, they're not opposition. It's orchestrated opposition. Now, capitalism, the Rothschild family referred to capitalism as the European plan. And, of course, the European plan was designed to further enrich the wealthy, as Senator Pettigrew mentioned. He urged young men to evade the draft, the World War I draft. The newspaper reported his remarks to a U.S. attorney who secured a felony indictment against him and had him accused of violating the Espionage Act of 1917. Is that just amazing what these people do? If somebody speaks out, then that's what happens. They get accused of doing something. Now, of course, with the internet, it's made it so much more possible for people to speak out and to speak out about the things that that are rotten. And the more people, the more of us who speak out, the more people will be educated. Hopefully, before it is too late. There's a lot of people out there that that are still brainwashed. Obviously, we're a big dumbed down population, but there are more and more people who are beginning to understand that that things are really awful. Let me read some of the comments here. All pharmaceutical companies worldwide work to FDA standards. That is absolutely true. The FDA is the de facto global standard, with maybe only Japan being more fussy. Okay. Back in the 90s, there was an international conference on harmonization for the international standardization of standards for pharmaceuticals. Okay. The same chatter said, it's not for nothing we are called human resources. Okay. The chatters are pretty astute bunch of people. Okay, let's see. Somebody said, about the frequency, who was it that was talking about frequency? Rockefeller Institute giving away for free instruments tuned to 440. Important to bring about a continuous unrest, warfare, etc. Excuse me. A 100,000 Indian farmers commit suicide every year because of Monsanto loans. Excuse me, that's quite a number. Let me get a drink here. Okay. Let me check and see if there's any phone calls. Somebody should call in so I could give my voice a rest. The telephone number is 646-787-1915. Anybody have any questions or comments? No? Okay. Let me check our email. All righty. From 1923 to 1924, the Rockefeller Foundation funded a study of scientific farming called the Montana Project, Fairway Farms Company. On February 24th, 1925, Congress passed the Purnell Act, which permitted the first funding of agricultural economics and rural sociology in land-grant universities. Using public funds, Montana State College created an agricultural economics department, the Montana Agricultural Experiment Station, under the direction of Milburn L. Wilson. Leading the department from 1926 to 1933, he focused on increasing farming profits. Now, that sounds like a really good idea. Hey, that sounds like it would be good for the farmer. Nope, it wasn't. The premise was that people would operate a dry farm like a cooperative business using mechanized technology and better economic principles. Now, keep in mind that this was the same time that Russia was attempting to collectivize farmers. Okay, well, what they did in Ukraine with the collectivization of farmers, they did here under different programs, but it ended up in the same way with the seizure, the destruction of the independent farmer, either through economic loans and credits or through destroying land, which ultimately they did, because they destroyed the land. And they did that through taking off the topsoil. Anyway, the premise was that people could operate a dry farm like a cooperative business using mechanized technology and better economic principles. Wilson also headed the USDA Division of Farm Management and Cost Accounting from 1924 to 1926. Montana farmers had plowed up the natural grazing lands to plant wheat. Now they struggle to make a living in, and I quote, an era of falling prices. Because as soon as the banks start loaning money for farmers to plant particular crops, and then those same bankers can manipulate the market so that the price falls. You know, you convince the farmer to stop grazing animals and plant wheat. And this was at about the same time that I think Kellogg came, oh my gosh, we only have 90 seconds. Anyway, this is about the same time that Kellogg came out and said, oh look, we could start using grain and we could start doing this and that. But we'll talk about this probably next, not next Monday, but next Thursday. We'll talk about how they destroyed the farmers, and how they replaced them. Well, I thank you very much for joining me today, and I hope you join me on my Saturday program when Dr. Linda Lagerman will be my guest. So, thanks so much for your support, for listening to the program, and I will talk with you on Saturday. Thank you so much. Bye-bye now. Start with you and me.